Hello, folks. Welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I am your host, Simon Ward, founder of thetriathloncoach.com, High Performance Human, and the SWOT Inner Circle. And I am on a mission to help you upgrade your human performance. I truly believe that we all have the potential to perform better as humans through improved sleep, nutrition, fitness, mobility, and stress management. And in doing so, live longer, live healthier, and of course, improve your athletic performance. Now, if you're interested in joining me on this journey, please check out my SWOT Inner Circle, where you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. All you need to do is email Beth at thetriathloncoach.com or look out for the link below in the show notes. Now on to this week's guest. For the past few weeks, I've been reading a book. It's called Peak, The New Science of Athletic Performance That is Revolutionizing Sports. And it's absolutely fascinating. In fact, I loved it so much that I gifted it to a dozen of the individuals I work with. So I'm delighted that the author of that book, Dr. Mark Bubbs, is my guest on today's podcast. Now, Dr. Bubbs is the performance nutrition lead for Canada Basketball and consults with pro sport teams in NBA, NHL, and MLB. And he's also an international speaker and a qualified strength and conditioning coach. What really attracted me to the book was that the first section, Foundation, focuses on sleep, microbiome, and nutrition. So it adopts a very similar format to my own vision of high performance humans. I had a lot of stuff to ask Mark, and unfortunately we didn't really manage to cover everything in detail. Now don't worry, he's already agreed to come back for another podcast, but we still covered a lot of topics, including why elite athletes have better immunity than most and how that helps them to get to and stay at the top. Why vitamin D is a must-have supplement during COVID to help with your immunity. How to get the basics right and why you must focus on process and mastery rather than outcome. Why lack of sleep affects immunity, health, and ultimately your training consistency. How to return to training after a bout of coronavirus. Training volume and how you can figure out the minimum effective dose for you to make progress. Talk about nutrition and why you should avoid the social media noise and go with the consensus. We talk about blood sugar and the benefits of wearing a constant glucose monitor. And we also talk about some of those other gadgets, such as sleep trackers and power meters, and making sure that you know why you're using them and what benefit you hope to gain from them. And finally, we talked about creatine supplementation and why it's worth considering for endurance athletes. So I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did, and let's crack on with today's guest. Okay, everyone, well, welcome to the show, Dr. Mark Bubbs. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, now, your book, Peak, Mark, I mentioned to you this before the call. I read the first couple of pages and thought, wow, this guy and I are on exactly the same journey here.
Awesome.
We're coming at it from the same direction. So I gifted this book to a dozen people for Christmas, and I have to say that the feedback has been amazing. So
fantastic.
I'll definitely be marking this up in the show notes and putting in some stars and asterisks around it to make people pay attention. So, listeners, awesome. I highly recommend Dr. Mark Bubbs' book, Peak. It's called The New Science of Athletic Performance That is Revolutionizing Sports. And that's what we're going to get into today, Mark. So,
fabulous. Looking forward to it.
So, before then, let's talk about how you got to the point in your life where you decided that you had to put it all down in a book. You know, take me through what your life was like as a child. Were you involved in sport? How you became a doctor and what you're a doctor of, and how you got into sports conditioning, and then, you know, to the esteemed level you're at now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll give you the short version because the long version might take a while. But the book came out of effectively just wanting to put down on paper, you know, my philosophy around supporting athletes, supporting human performance. So all of us in our day-to-day lives trying to achieve our own personal bests in whatever activity it is, or even, you know, work, or obviously, you know, I work with athletes as well, and team sport and Olympic athletes and these types of things. And so, you know, trying to put down the philosophies of what these high achievers are doing. And when you do that, you realize, and working in sport, I work with Canada Basketball as the performance nutrition lead for our Olympic team. And again, you know, various team sport athletes, et cetera, is that, you know, these best of the best athletes aren't, you know, the foundation of what they're doing is rooted in the fundamentals, right? They are experts in the fundamentals. And when you're an expert in the fundamentals, you look flashy, right? It's almost like looking at Messi or Ronaldo or LeBron James or, you know, whatever sport. It looks impressive, even though what they're doing is just really having solidified and created the habits that make those foundational pieces, you know, what we call the big rocks, a big part of anyone's regime. And so, you know, in the book, we go through athlete health and we go through fueling for various sports and recovery and the mindset piece, and that whole totality of health and mindset and how you fuel and recovery is really kind of this holistic picture. And it's interesting because when you go to performance conferences, you know, I was recently at the Football Medicine Conference in London in the UK, and you know, to a person, all these talks done by Premiership performance staffs, you know, the 6 inches between the ears is sort of the next frontier. And, you know, we call that the placebo effect, but, you know, but it's the placebo effect is statistically significant, and it's just as powerful as, you know, some of the best medications if we talk about, from the health side of things. So the book was really about, you know, putting that philosophy down, and my background's in sport, and I had a deep interest in nutrition in high school and university. And this was back in the late 90s when teams didn't even have performance nutritionists or sport dietitians. And so I ended up going down a path in America. You can become a naturopathic doctor, which is having a medical lens on applying things like nutrition. So it's been really cool to see over the last 20 years. I mean, nutrition's just exploded in everyone's the front of everyone's mind, right? We see, whether it's general public doctors, you go on Instagram. I mean, a lot of people thinking about nutrition now, which is tremendous, because whether you're trying to improve your health, improve your performance, it's a big pillar.
There's a couple of things. Well, there's a few things that I'd like to pick up on there. The naturopathic doctor thing is interesting to me. Would that be the same as homeopathy then, or similar?
No, actually, it's quite different than homeopathy. So it's effectively just, you know, how a GP would practice. So it's not emergency medicine, but with a focus on using nutrition, exercise, lifestyle. And so, and it's actually different on, you know, it does get a little bit confusing because even between the UK and America, the qualifications are quite different. So it's, you know, in America and Canada, it's a full-time medical degree, that type of thing. But effectively it's a holistic look at chronic conditions. So in my general practice, I work with people who are struggling with, you know, prediabetes, diabetes, you know, hypertension, heart conditions, and it's, you know, there is a place for medications when they need them, but it's amazing how what you eat, how you move, lifestyle factors are just the driving force behind that. And again, you see doctors now compared to 20 years ago, you know, most cardiologists and everyone's on board with that, right?
So, pardon my ignorance, then, would that be the same as functional medicine, or is there a difference again there? Are we getting closer now?
We're getting closer, but that's sort of a broad umbrella term. Right. And so, you know, yeah, so we'll leave it at that. not to go too far down the rabbit hole. It's basically a holistic view of how we can treat people, whether it's general health, athlete health. And, you know, of course I went on to do, you know, my master's in performance nutrition, exercise nutrition. And so that's where over the years, my work with Canada Basketball actually stemmed out of supporting team sport athletes who were kind of run down, sick and tired. And the typical sort of fueling that we might do with a sport dietitian, let's say, wasn't getting the whole story, wasn't fixing the whole problem. And so that's where that holistic lens, and about, you know, maybe actually probably a decade ago now, that's how things kicked off on that sports side.
I see you're a fellow CSCS as well. So I just had to recertify this December. So I got my certificate through yesterday. It reminded me that my certification was 1999. And I think I was nice. The first intake that they did in the UK, because it was basically largely a US-based organization up until that point, I think the NFCA.
Yeah, for sure.
But there was no UK Strength and Conditioning Association back in those days.
Yeah, now you guys are going strong. Great organization, UK SCA.
So you talked about the fundamentals there, and that's mm-hmm. That I hear athletes, because most of the people I work with now are recreational athletes. So,
yep.
You know, people who are trying to squeeze, and I choose that word because that seems like what it is. They're squeezing training for an Ironman or an ultramarathon in between all of these other sort of plates that they've got to spin.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Competing for mental and physical energy. But And often they're bemoaning the fact that, you know, well, you know, I wasn't born, I didn't choose the right parents, I didn't have the right team, never going to be able to run that fast. But you make a great point there about the fundamentals. Is there's nothing to stop you being world-class at sleeping and having a world-class pre-sleep routine. There's nothing to stop you being world-class at mobility. You know, those. There's nothing to stop you being world-class at preparing real food to eat and getting good nutrition. You know, those things just require time and attention and behavioral habits, which is something we'll come to later, because that's the last one of the last paragraph sort of sections in your book about forming habits.
For sure, Simon. If I can jump in too, I mean, when you look at like a team sport, if you don't have the coordination to play football, basketball, you can't even pass go. The beauty of endurance sport or even bodybuilding is that it's largely just a function of your effort and time, right? Mm-hmm. There's a component of genetic VO2 max, but it really is a great endeavor, because the more time and the more effort you put in, you can achieve these really great outcomes versus, you know, some of these team sports where if you don't have the hand-eye coordination, it's going to be tough to become Steph Curry.
Yeah, trying to catch that ball. And I mean, you only have to watch this. I think you probably had superstars in the US and Canada, didn't you? I remember watching an international version with some Canadian athletes. But when you get recently, they revived it, and Alistair Brownlee and Mo Farah were in one. And when it came to endurance stuff, they were great. When it came to the coordination stuff, they were okay, but they were miles behind some of the multi-sport or the team athletes and some of those guys that have great endurance, but also have that good movement pattern, a bit multi-directional pattern movement hand-eye coordination. Yeah. You also talked there about mindset. And now I had Alex Hutchinson on. You're probably familiar with Alex, and he wrote that book Endure, and that's his now is that what's the next big research area and the next big leap forward in athlete performance is going to come through being able to access the mind. And he talks about some of the Tim Noakes stuff, you know, the central governor theory and sort of access that. But again, there's nothing to stop recreational athletes having a super powerful mindset, is there? And that's it. So that's something that anybody can tap into if they apply themselves.
Yeah. And I think it's all about, you know, starting from where you're at, knowing what your goal is and going at it in a slow and steady pace, right? You know, we don't become world-class at anything overnight, and we want to make, anytime we're trying to change behavior, we're trying to make the gap as small as we can. And so if the first thing we introduce is too big a stretch, if it's too much effort or too much, it's going to be tough for that to stick. But to your point, you can absolutely, and mindset is a huge one, especially when we talk about how important that is for endurance sport, because it does require this mindset to be able to show up and do the training. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the best research in the world, the athletes who perform the best are the ones who showed up the most and did the training the most. You know, the ones who get tired and sick and run down, you can draw a straight line in terms of their performance. And so, you know, that's really where we used to think, well, if we work hard, we achieve a certain amount, we're going to get this mindset of confidence. But now, you know, performance psychologists and performance coaches are talking about how do we get this mindset to this space first? And then that can then catapult helping us to show up every day, to put the effort in. And now we really, you know, amplify that whole cycle.
Well, and that's an interesting chicken and egg scenario, isn't it? Is do I develop my fitness first, and then when I feel like I can't go any further, do I develop my mindset to give me the extra edge, or do I start off by developing that and then put the fitness on top? And I often, when I look at people's training programs, I often think they've perhaps got it the wrong way around.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be individual and context driven. I think just showing up every day to your, you know, if you develop a plan and your client has to then execute it, that in and of itself is starting to build mindset. Cause as you know, with all your clients, endurance training requires a lot of sessions in a week. And so you've got to commit, you've got to show up. And I think that's where it's really nice, where if you can judge yourself and be process oriented and say, hey, did I show up today? Did I tick off that workout? Then that's a win. Versus always thinking that you have to have had a great workout, or the workout had to feel fantastic. You know, I think sometimes that's where, when we look at recreational athletes, we get a little too drawn into, you know, the better the workout felt, then it must have been a better workout.
Yeah, and I mean, you make a great point there. It's that process and mastery versus outcome. And I think that's one of the differences between recreation and elite athletes, is they're focused on the process. What do I need to do better today, rather than, you know, was my run today faster than yesterday? It doesn't necessarily need to be, as long as it's better on game day.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge, right? Because people fall into that trap of like, I've got to run faster every time. Every session in the gym, I have to lift more weight. If I'm trying to lose weight, I've got to be losing weight every week. If I'm stuck in a plateau, then something's really wrong, you know? And so when we become too outcome focused, we lose track of being process oriented and present state focused, which can lead to things like anxiety and affect our behaviors. And it has a huge, probably the number one roadblock in terms of people not achieving success, right? It's like they're so focused on the down the road that even though we say, did you do this little thing today? You know, that's the thing I want to judge you on. You know, unfortunately too focused on that outcome goal. And it's a bit like, you know, if you're serving a tennis ball or trying to hit a golf ball and all you're thinking about is I got to hit it in or I need to hit it in the fairway, good luck. I mean, it's probably not going to go there, right? Whereas if you're thinking about, you know, a swing cue or a ball toss cue or something like that, process oriented, that's what the best of the best do, right? And that's why they hit so many fairways and hit it in so often.
And that comes from just repetition every day, doing the basics. And again, there's nothing to stop us practicing those basic skills every day and getting better at them.
Yeah, I mean, if you can ingrain the right patterns, then it's a lot harder for things to go wrong, right? Because, you know, again, with golf, the difference between even a 10 handicapper and the best golfer in the world, if they hit their best shots, they end up not too far away from one another. The problem is when they hit their worst shots, you know, the professional golfer is just off the fairway and the 10 handicapper is 50 yards into the bush. And so, you know, we're trying to really just, you know, put some bumpers, if you will, to kind of make it so that it's harder for things to go wrong, you know. And when you develop the right habits, when you develop the right mindset, it just makes it harder for things to go too far off piste. You know, you're going to be much more apt to be, you know, close to on point.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about consistency then, because whenever I talk to elite coaches, that word always comes up as one of the key determinants of success. And whenever you listen to particularly endurance athletes and the commentator says to them, well, what's, you know, you've had a great run of form this year, what's behind it? And they'll say, well, I had a perfect winter, I didn't miss a session. You know, it just, that whole thing comes up time and again is consistency. So, and you talked about some of the obstacles to consistency. And I guess for all athletes, the puzzle is finding out, well, what things do I need to do in my life to make sure I'm consistent, to make sure that I can arrive at the training session tomorrow? Okay. So you have a particular order in your book. I'll just read it out now and we can sort of go through it. But you start out with the foundation. So this whole thing must have been deliberate in terms of these are the order of things that you need to put in to make sure you can turn up. And if you can just, I mean, the first chapter is on sleep and circadian rhythms. Yep. Now, sleep is the foundation for all human performance, whether you're a little baby, you know, developing and they sleep all the time, somebody recovering from an illness or an operation, to elite athletes recovering from training and preparing. So I guess that was no accident you put that there, but I just wondered,
yeah, I mean,
when you were thinking about the order of the book, what was the process going through your mind?
I mean, sleep is just foundational for health, right? It's fundamental for human health. We haven't been able to outsource it in the hundreds of thousands of years we've been walking on the planet, right? We still need to get this sleep. We haven't found a way to get around it. And it's interesting on the athletic front. I mean, sleep science in the last 10 years has really exploded. And, you know, the work of Dr. Sherry Ma at Stanford University, when she was doing some of her original research, it was on cognition. So in athletes, extending sleep to see the effects on cognitive function. And of course, these athletes would roll up and a swimmer would say, hey, I just had a personal best time in the pool. And then a basketball player would show up and say, hey, I just scored more points than I ever had. And then, you know, a weightlifter would show up and say, I just had a personal best. And so, all the researchers started saying, wait a minute, we've got to start testing some physical performance outcomes. And of course, on the back end of that, they found that, again, sprint times, reaction times, shooting percentages, first serve percentages, all these things were improving when you extended sleep from that sort of 6.5, 7 towards 8. And so that's a huge aspect of human and athletic performance, to be able to have that real tangible gain from kind of, for lack of a better term, doing nothing, right? Getting more sleep. And then, you know, the other piece is on the immune side. And this is where some of these loops start to connect when we talk about, you know, athlete health, is that if you don't get enough sleep, and this is some of the, you know, landmark studies by Professor Sheldon Cohen in the 90s, actually inoculated people with the cold and flu virus. And And so, you know, if you got less than 7 hours of sleep, you were three times more likely to get sick, right? And if you're less than 6 hours of sleep, then it was 4.5 times more likely. And so this is where we start to see, to your point, recreational athletes, in particular endurance athletes, because it's a lot of time to train. We're now all of a sudden we're cutting into our sleep to be able to get some of these things in. Now that's going to increase the stress load on the body and sacrifice ability to recover and potentially performance. And on top of that, you know, you mentioned before, you know, busy work schedules or, you know, home life. So this mental emotional stress or the busyness in your life is also part of your quote unquote training load, right? And so we need to factor all those things together to find out the right dose for that individual, because if you're sleeping 5 hours a night, if your work's really stressful, if your home life is also stressful, those things matter, and you've got to find out, you know, that sort of right plan. And so, yeah, sleep is a fundamental piece. And we talk about, you know, blood sugar control as well as another area that if you find the right diet for yourself, you know, your glucose levels will be on point. And then we also talk digestion as well. And that's more for when digestion goes wrong, it can really derail everything. And you can, you know, in endurance athletes, we often see, you know, issues with bloating and discomfort and things like that.
Let's talk about sleep a bit more. We're in the middle of this COVID
for sure
pandemic at the moment, but we've started, you're right in the middle of it here, so you won't have been able to avoid the fact that we're getting on with the delivering the vaccines to people now.
Yeah.
And I started to, I was lucky enough to get my own vaccine last week. Just it was a fluke that I managed to respond to a tweet that allowed me to get onto a queue. You know, I'm not in that age yet, and I'm certainly not in the vulnerable category, but
yeah,
it did leave me feeling a little down for the 6 hours, and it got me to thinking about how best to prepare for the vaccine. And so I was reading some research about, you talked about people who are getting less than 6 or 7 hours sleep there. And I started reading on, you know, I think you mentioned it in your book, and there's a book by a book called Go Wild as well, where I've read also in there that they talk about when people are getting less than 7 hours sleep a night, there's a reduced efficiency of the vaccine. Mm. And you mentioned that in there as well with respect to athletes that are traveling and maybe having vaccines before they go to foreign countries. Have you had any thoughts on this at all around vaccine efficacy and advice that you're giving out to your athletes and clients?
Well, I'll tell you what, Simon, I just had a pretty nasty bout of COVID in, you know, a month back, and, you know, it's interesting, you know, infectious diseases can catch us regardless if we're, you know, it's good to obviously be healthy and be fit. That will help to reduce typically your chances of infection and severity. But, you know, if you do get an infectious disease, I mean, it was a rough go, right? It was 2 weeks of intense symptoms. Wow. You know, I lost 12 pounds of muscle mass over 21 days. Oxygen saturation, which is the amount of oxygen in your blood, which is normally like 97, 98, 99. You know, mine was down as low as 92, 91 and in the upper 80s for days. And so all of a sudden going up the stairs feels like climbing Mount Everest. And so when you do get an infectious disease like that, I mean, the challenging part is just to know that it's going to take a long time. You know, like a typical cold or flu, you know, your body mounts an immune response in 5, 6, 7 days. So you start to feel better after 5 or 6 days or even earlier. Whereas with COVID, it's a 10 to 12 days before you start feeling any better. And so that's one of the challenges of, you know, when we think that we can just take something once we have it, typically in a regular cold or flu, that might be the case. But with a really nasty infectious disease like that, you do have to ride it out, but you're, you know, to that point, with breathing and other things, I think this is where maintaining aerobic fitness and metabolic health will help you to not go over that deeper end of having real complications. And, you know, circling back to your point about, you know, vaccines, I mean, it's, if you can get the vaccine, absolutely, you know, go for it. And, you know, a day of not feeling so great, again, not to go too deep, but I had many years ago coming back from West Africa, I had malaria, and that one, you know, COVID was for me twice as bad as malaria. Wow. So it's, so yeah, getting your sleep is great. You know, the social distancing, washing your hands is tremendous. You know, things like vitamin D can be helpful for, you know, protectively, but we do see just a big study came out showing that if you do have COVID, even in patients, giving them vitamin D doesn't shorten the severity or duration. So So, you know, like most infectious diseases, just best not to get it in the first place. But yeah, if we can get everybody vaccinated now, that's the fastest way to get back to normal and get everybody back to their, you know, endurance competitions and Ironmans and triathlons and all that good stuff.
Well, my advice based on the stuff I've been reading was, because some of that other research, I think there was two studies. One was on the H1N1 virus, the bird flu, and vaccines there. And the other one was on the hepatitis B one. And both of those bits of research from USCF, I think, were pointing to the fact that reduced sleep then impacts the efficiency of the vaccine to, you know, be offer protection. But sure. Equally, there was some other stuff in there about psychological stress. So my advice to people before they had the vaccine was ease back on your training, plan in a couple of days of easy training afterwards, just in case you feel rough, you know, and just give yourself a bit of self-compassion, which is something else you mentioned in your book in the last chapter. There is about that, you know, resilience comes from being having self-compassion. It's not a pity party. So, you
know, yeah, exactly. Right.
There's lots of sort of things joining up and connecting here, isn't there, in the way we take care of ourselves, leading to great performance.
That's the body, right? The body's holistic. The body doesn't know itself as systems. It's all interconnected for sure. So the mindset, immunity, sleep, all these things are talking to each other, the gut, all the time, right?
I had a podcast call with another probably peer of yours, Professor Paul Larson,
nice.
Canadian. And
yeah, Paul's great.
I've had Paul on the show four or five times. I've known him for a few years, along with Dr. Dan Palouse as well. Another guy
in the book. Both Prof and Palouse are in the book for sure.
They are. We were talking about vitamin D, and that was one of the supplements he recommended as a sort of coverall. You know, 24/7 for most people, particularly where we're living now in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, you don't get much
natural
vitamin D for 6 months. We also talked about this long COVID. Have you been suffering long COVID at all? And do you think that long COVID is just a focus now because it's a topical issue? But is it really any different to post-viral syndrome that people get if they start training too soon after the flu?
Well, I'm just recovering from my COVID. You know, I've actually, just this past week started feeling a little bit back to normal, although still underweight. But I think, you know, this is where people need to make sure that they're touching base with their docs. You know, one of my best friends, university, is the head of infectious diseases out west in BC. And so, you know, it's really important for people to be communicating with their docs. And if they do have COVID, with the IDs, the infectious disease experts, and make sure that communication is really key, because it's easy now to get a lot of information, you know, on social media, and it can take people in a lot of different directions. So I would say with long COVID, I mean, if people are feeling like they're starting to have those symptoms, then yeah, you need to take, you know, movement and exercise we know is good for the immune system. But if you're struggling with recovery, then too much intense training is going to be tough on the system, mm-hmm. right? And you're going to struggle to recover, and you're going to suppress immune function. And so that's one where if you're an endurance athlete, which is, you know, obviously your community, you've got to tiptoe your way around that. And that's tough because a lot of people are type A's and they're used to like, hey, I feel all right. Let's go right back to training. I'm going to hit right where I was before. You know, we're going straight back into this. I'm going to make up for lost time. It's like, no. Okay. If you feel like you might have long COVID, we've got to do this differently. And so I think that would be one of the things of just really trying to identify that. And if other coaches are listening into this who have endurance athletes, it's building out that plan and making sure that that person's, you know, GP or infectious disease doc is incorporated in that.
Yeah, because you talk about social media. We have several Ironman specific Facebook pages, and I keep seeing posts now from people saying, "Yeah, I've got long COVID, but I've also got an Ironman in 7 months. How long will it be before I can get back into some hard training?" I'm like, "Well, you know, what's most important to you? Getting that medal or living a long, healthy life? Because I know which one I'd be prioritizing right now."
And it's so individual. This is the tricky part, right? Like there's, it's so context driven that it's tough to give general recommendations, because you really have to take, you know, how is that individual responding to their training, to their nutrition, to their sleep, to all the points that we made. And then based off of that, you can then start to lever up or down what's happening. But yeah, it's tough when you have just type A's who are just mm-hmm. chomping at the bit to get back in the saddle. And that's when it's not always obviously a bad thing, but it's, you just got to do it with a bit of wisdom maybe, or looking at the big picture.
Well, while we're talking about athlete immunity, I was really interested to read the section in the book. I think it's chapter eight, where you talk about specifically about immunity. You talk about upper respiratory symptoms versus upper respiratory tract infection. So that's like a precursor when you get a little bit of a sniffle, you've got a little bit of, you know, sort of feeling like you need to clear your throat. And these are probably, if you're in touch with your body, these are probably indicators that your body's struggling to cope with stuff and that you need to back off. But of course, a lot of people don't. They crack on and then they develop a sore throat and then it becomes a bit worse. You talk about this, the J-shaped curve. So I'll put something like about this in the show notes, I think. I'll create a little slide. But basically, the J-shaped curve goes, if you're a non-exerciser, you start exercising, you start with a low immunity, but as you exercise and get a bit fitter, your immunity improves and you become stronger and healthier. So you've got you're down at the bottom of the J. But then as you start to train and you maybe get a thirst for doing something competitive, you take on the task of running for doing a 10K or a marathon or an Ironman or whatever. As you push closer to the limits of what you're capable of with, along with all the other stress in your life, your immunity gets compromised. And that's where it stops for most people. But you say that scientists have now discovered an S-shaped curve where at the top of that J, the line starts to drop. And this is why elite athletes get to the level they're at, because they have this ability to, you know, get this high volume of training in, and actually that strengthens their immune system. So my question there was, which comes first? Did they have strong resiliency and the training enabled them to get there and it's just like the strongest will survive? Or did they develop this strong immunity by just managing everything and pushing on through and building that sort of strength of immune system?
That's the million-dollar question that exercise immunologists are trying to figure out. But effectively, you know, this is, again, there's tremendous research. You know, Professor Neil Walsh, formerly of Bangor University, now up at Liverpool, John Morris, doing this work in this area. And effectively what they found was these, you know, international-level competitors, the best of the best, get sick less than everybody else. So we do know that if you can just show up to training, if we can push you hard and put that volume and intensity in and keep you healthy enough to recover to show up again the next day, that's a great predictor of success. Now, to your point, you know, what exactly drives that? Well, there's likely a genetic component to it. There's likely a nutrition component to it. There's likely a sleep component to it. There's likely a mindset component to it. There's all these different factors that are, you know, really challenging to tease out. But it is important to know that, you know, again, and coaches as well, and you probably pick up on this anyway, if you have certain clients that you can really push hard and yeah, they sleep fine, they recover well, they're sore, but their numbers still look good and you keep pushing forward. And you probably have other clients where you have, you know, maybe we're a similar level and you're applying similar strategies and you're like, oh, wait a minute, that person's, you know, we're seeing the power output drop or their resting heart rate's going up or they're not sleeping as well. And now it's like, oh, geez, I got to change this plan. I've got to pull back a little bit and do things a little bit differently with this individual. And so, you know, and classically in places like China, you see, you know, with Olympic weightlifting, they just have so many people. They just put everybody in a room and just crush everybody. And then whoever's left standing at the end is the one who they can train because they can cope with the greatest amount of stress. And so it's a fascinating area for sure.
Yeah. I like that whole thing there because that is where recreational athletes sometimes struggle, is that they want to do more training. They read about what the elites are doing. They almost occasionally, well, probably more often than not, become overly focused on the training component as the thing that's going to take them close to the goal. But in doing so, they start to compromise other stuff. So what you typically see is, I'll get up earlier to do that session now. So I'll, instead of getting up at 6:30, I'll get up at 5:30 and then I can fit an extra hour in. So they're upping the training, but they're reducing the sleep. So, of course, training volume goes up, but opportunity for recovery goes down. And that means the seesaw's now out of balance. And, you know, it makes that whole, everything just gets a little out of kilter, doesn't it?
100%. And it's interesting because it's, you know, midlife is oftentimes when people are ramping this up. And actually my upcoming book's called Peak 40. And it's a dive into how we have to change things a little bit in midlife and be more efficient with things, because typically people are working longer hours at work and or have kids at home and are sleeping less, and all of these factors that contribute in to their overall kind of training load or life load, if you will. And so, yeah, we need to be more strategic, and we got to aim for, you know, we got to look at minimum effective dose as the first protocol. Whereas if we were in our 20s, we could look at the, you know, maximum volume, maximum dose that we could apply to kind of hit that stressor. And so that's where a little bit of the mind shift happens as well. When we're in 30s, 40s, 50s, we've got to just be a little bit smarter with how we apply it, which is why you need, you know, training with a coach is so important, because you need an extra set of eyes. If you're trying to do this all by yourself, it's really tough to navigate.
Yeah, minimum effective dose. I think I wrote a post on that years ago, and a lot of people just immediately thought I was talking about taking drugs, because they just look, yeah, like typically in the sort of social media world, you look at the headline and then bang in with some sort of comments rather than reading the whole the content.
Yeah, it is a pharma word for sure.
Yeah, but again, some of the great coaches that I know often refer to that. What's the least amount of training you can do to keep improving, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it's a great place to start, because when you do the least amount of training, what do you get more of? Yeah. Sleep and recovery. Right. And so now all of a sudden you're getting it, but I mean, what you're after is the adaptation, as you know, right? And I think oftentimes we don't pick the low hanging fruit. So if we're starting a new program, it's like, no, I only want you to train, you know, two or three times a week or whatever it might be. Like, you're going to get the adaptation at that low dose. So you don't need to go higher now. You know, we can always make it harder or more intense, but let's take the easy wins while we've got them, and then we can layer things on. And I think that's another hard one for type A's, because it's always like more is better, harder is better, you know, that type of mentality.
Well, to that point, I remember a guy coming to me, wanted to do an Ironman, had not really got much triathlon experience. And that's the way it seems to go now. You know, when I started out nearly 30 years ago, people, we start out with a short distance and work up to Ironman. Now people just
much more sensible.
Bang straight in, like, I'm just going to find the hardest Ironman in the world, and that'll be my debut into the multi-sport arena.
Exactly.
But this guy came to me and he said, look, I want to train for this Ironman. He picked a hard one. And I'd said, right, let's, you know, looked at his training history. Okay, let's try and work on building from 8 to 10 hours a week. And he kept coming back and saying, yeah, but I keep reading all these people saying I need to be doing 15 hours a week. I'm like, yeah, but will your body be able to cope with that? You've not really done that volume before. If we wrap up too quickly, you'll be injured and then there'll be no training. Yeah. Anyway, I, you know, held his hand through all of this. We kept him calm and he averaged 8 to 10 hours a week consistently for 6 months, and he absolutely crushed it. But that's awesome. That's a great example of what you're saying there, is you have to start with what, get the low hanging fruit, and, you know, rather than doing 5 hours a week extra training, use that 5 hours for working on your mobility, for meditating, for preparing great food, for going to bed 15 minutes earlier every night.
And to your point, if you start lower, you've got more room to build it out over the months. And so you can be consistent with your training, which I'm sure you always see is the people who come out of the gates all guns blazing in month one, by the end of month two or three, now we're injured or we got niggling issues. And now we've got to downshift the amount of volume. And now we're just having to play catch up. And it's like, wait a minute, we could have avoided all this had we just done it, you know, the right way from the jump.
So going back to the book, the second chapter is an interesting one, because probably a lot of people aren't inhabiting the world that we inhabit and are sort of reading this information regularly. May not be familiar with the microbiome. They might have seen small pieces about it in the Sunday journals or occasionally in the running magazines. But this is a huge, in term, as well as the brain and how the mind can accelerate performance, the microbiome is a huge area of untapped research, isn't it? And yet the gut is the second brain. You know, you speak to gut specialists and they'll say the amount of things that the gut controls, you know, in the body, is huge. I think is it Brian Walsh? I saw Dr. Brian Walsh, he's a Canadian guy. I saw a presentation from him about the 16 lipopolysaccharides and all of the things that they impact and the negative impacts they have on all sorts of things, from brain health to blood sugar mechanisms to moods and recovery.
Yeah,
100%.
I mean, the gut... It's in 70% of the immune system, more or less, is in the gut. And so, you know, from your mouth to your backside is an open tube, and it's exposed to the environment, and it's it's how our immune system gets exposed to all the new terrain, right? That's actually why when you have little babies crawling around, they're putting things in their mouth, right? The brain is trying to expose itself to the environment. So it does play a huge factor. It's just interesting in the fact that, you know, what we eat and how we move plays a big role in the diversity of all these different gut microbes. And, you know, there's a lot of noise in around the gut microbiome and whatnot, but there's really only one thing we can hang our hats on in terms of what the science says. And that's that, you know, the more diversity tends to reflect better health, right? And so when we look at specifically to endurance athletes, one of the challenges we can get into is if we're fueling a lot with simple sugars, that drives a certain species of bacteria up that can cause some issues and some inflammation and, you know, blood sugar imbalances and these types of things. Now, the benefit from the endurance athlete is that aerobic fitness is great for gut bacteria. So you tend to get a bit of a buffer there. But people who struggle with, you know, gas, bloating, discomfort from, you know, what they're taking in during or around training, you know, that can let you know that there's some areas that you could upgrade. And the other one, and you see this a lot in Ironman, is when you get so used to having to fuel so much, especially with simple sugars, that if you miss a meal, you know, you are not a nice person to be hanging around at the office, or, you know, all of a sudden you take a nap under your desk or that type of hangry feeling. Mm-hmm. That's when you also know that we need to maybe adjust how we fuel, you know, in training sessions or away from training to kind of make the most of your health and that gut diversity.
How do you feel about the idea of athletes having their microbiome tested and finding out exactly what bacteria they might have, what foodstuffs they need to eat, maybe sort of giving them some guidance on what sort of nutrition might be best for their particular genetic makeup?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you run a test, you know, if you're coming at it from a medical lens, the test should influence which pathway you take in terms of strategy. The results of the test should say, okay, I'm going to go left or I'm going to go right. If the results of the test don't do that, if it doesn't do that, then it's not a need to know, it's a nice to know. And nice to know is fine, but it doesn't always give you the value that you're looking for. And so again, when we talk about testing the gut, you know, gut diversity is going to be the main thing that we want to look for, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have low gut diversity, moderate gut diversity, high gut diversity? If it's low and you're an endurance athlete, well, we got to work on that. And typically increasing the diversity of one's diet is going to be a big starting point for that. When we get into kind of adding specific foods to bump specific species, that's where it gets, you know, there's a lot more noise in the research when you speak to researchers around, you know, if we can do that, how that impacts. But certainly, you know, when we talk about eating whole foods, if we eat more unprocessed foods, we tend to get a lot more bang for our buck in terms of gut bacteria. But what might your listeners might find interesting is that there are some correlations. So Dr. Lauren Jackson, Lauren Peterson, rather, at formerly the Jackson Laboratory, you know, in her research, she found that downhill racers, so bike racers, they were, you know, they had a, she could predict who was in the top 25th percentile based on a certain strain, Prevotella, that's bacteria in their guts. And so there is these associations that start to crop up of, you know, these type of athletes train in this type of energy system or zone. They eat these types of foods, therefore they have. Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side of that is that if we just give you more Prevotella, you're probably not going to just all of a sudden become top 25th percentile of the race, but it does reflect the fact that if you run a test and you find that you're lower in that, then the cue is, okay, now it's time for you and coach to circle back and say, are we doing the right training plan? What does our nutrition look like? Are we sleeping enough? And so I think that's where the value of some of those tests come is revisiting areas and just shining a light on them to see if where the gaps might be.
You, I think you made reference to somebody in your book about the 50 foods. Are you getting 50 different vegetables in each week? I did a podcast with a functional gut health specialist in Australia, Bella Linderman, and she, when we were talking about real foods, she mentioned this. She said that she talked about diversity and variety. Mm-hmm. You know, different colors is a good one to start with. Is trying to see what range of colors you can get. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, see if you can get 40 different foods. You know, and you can count if you've got red, yellow, green, and orange bell peppers, then you can have those as four different foods because there'll be different minerals and vitamins in those. If you've got red and white onions, that's fine. If you've got different nuts, but yeah, we had people counting up. I think I got to 32 and thought I was doing quite well there. We had some people counting up and said, well, not even double figures here. So there would be a start if you want to, rather than trying to find out where the keto or low carb, high fat or paleo works for you, just see how many different vegetables you can get for a start.
Oh, for sure. Because I mean, you know, if we think of the best physique competitors and bodybuilders in the world, they typically only eat 14 or 15 different food items. Yeah. And that's a function of they need to really control caloric intake. And if you keep your diet limited, then you really know how much energy is in all the different foods. And it's easy for you to turn the dials on how much and how little is going in. Now, of those 15 items, they eat really clean, right? I mean, the bodybuilders eat virtually no sugar, you know, different types of proteins, different vegetables within that 15 food items. And so if you're an endurance athlete and you kind of notice, hey, I'm only eating 12 or 15 or 20, you know, Dr. Miguel Mateus's 50 food challenge, it's great because it's kind of big and out there. But a nice way is, to your point, is just to, okay, how do we get five more items this week? How do I go to the grocery store today? And my challenge is I'm going to pick three things or four things that I don't normally eat that are different colors, could be different grains, could be different proteins, shellfish, mussels, whatever. But it's just, it's a nice way to just nudge people towards more diversity. And, you know, people find things like, clams are something that not a lot of people eat, but you can buy a tin of clams for less than a dollar. And it's, you know, 100 times as good as the protein bar for $4, right? And you can mix it into stews and soups or on salads and all these types of things. So it's just all about slowly developing some of that creativity and some of that variety in someone's diet.
Interesting, though, that there is some discussion. You familiar with Mark Sisson and Brad Cairns?
Yeah.
We talked about prime endurance, of course. Yeah. And Mark talks, him and Brad have got this new book out, The Two Meals a Day, and they talk about, Mark used to talk about how his first meal a day would be at lunchtime and he'd have a big salad. But I know that they talked a lot to Dr. Paul Saladino. So he's the guy who's written The Carnivore Diet. And they're talking about actually why you shouldn't have lots and lots of vegetables because of the sort of abrasive effect of all of that fiber on the gut lining, and perhaps why you should. And then Mark's saying that in his particular case, he's reduced the amount of salads he's eating now. So that, again, I can see how people get confused with us. Is we're talking about vegetables and minerals and food diversity, and yet you then get these books and conversations that are getting traction where they're saying actually eat less fiber because it may not be good for your gut. So
I would just say we've got to watch the amount of noise that there is out there, and so it's easy to pick up on a tangent that reflects 0.5% of people.
Yeah.
Like when we get back to this discussion on fundamentals, you know, this is where in general, more fiber is going to be better for you. To your point, if you're struggling with an autoimmune disease like Crohn's, colitis, that's actually an indication where, you know what, less fiber might be better for you. But yeah, it is confusing because it's, if you're always just going to different strategies, this diet, that diet, and you don't understand the principles, like what are the big rocks that I'm supposed to get in? You know, it's like that analogy. Like if I can teach you how to fish, you can figure out the problems. You can navigate problems yourself. But if I'm always catching the fish for you, i.e. you're going from this diet to that diet to that diet, you're always going to struggle because inevitably there's going to be a roadblock, right? And so, you know, that's what I encourage people. And that's why even with Peak, you know, we're trying to just talk about what are some of these principles. If we could establish these, you're much more likely to have success. And then certainly you can personalize and turn those dials, but it just takes a lot of the confusion out of it. Because to your point, it's like, this guy says lots of vegetables. That guy says not a lot of vegetables. It's like, this person says high protein. This person says low protein. It just becomes, whereas when we look at the research, it's actually a lot more common ground of like what we should be doing versus, you know, what we hear, you know, on social.
Yeah. It's actually that takes me on to one of the questions that some of the listeners who've read your book, sent in some questions. And, one guy said, the topic of endurance or performance nutrition is so complex, I find that when I'm feeling like I have some grasp of it, another theory pops up, like we've just discussed, and that could be the issue. This means that in reality, I tend to focus on eating real food and avoiding rubbish. If that's a starting point, what would you add to that? But I think, you know, I think most people, if they could conquer that, would be a long way along, a long way towards their goal, wouldn't they?
I mean, well, that's a great one, right? I mean, eating more unprocessed food, you know, again, in the book, we talk about how in Canada, in the UK, in the US, over 50% of everything we eat is a packaged or processed food. And, you know, it blows me away because over here in the UK, you can get on a train in London and 2 hours later, you're in Paris, you step out of the train station and now, like a miracle, 14% of all the food eaten in France is processed, right? So one of the, you know, secrets, if you will, of the Mediterranean diet is that when you go to Spain and Portugal and Italy and France and Greece, they're not consuming a lot of processed food, right? It's like 15 to 20%. And so that's a fantastic place to start, is whether it's animal proteins, plant-based proteins, vegetables, grains, all that good stuff. Where it gets nuanced is when you're more performance driven, right? Because if you're 20 or 30 pounds overweight, adding more, let's say, sugar to your diet, especially around exercise even, can be a problem. If you're running at 18 kilometers an hour or 20, you know, 19 kilometers an hour, if you're moving fast in your triathlon or your Ironman, you need fuel, right? It's like a really hot fire. And when you have a really hot fire, it doesn't really matter if you put the best quality log you have on or any old piece of furniture, it burns, right? It burns right up. And so that's a really hard part for people to wrap their heads around, of like, hey, this individual is really competitive and moving fast. We're going to, you know, quote unquote, we're giving them sugar, but it's being burned up at the rate it's being given in. And so you're not seeing these negative inflammatory effects and other things, versus, you know, the analogy would be when we have that client who's, again, a bit overweight, and we give them too much fuel. So we give them the same amount of sugar. It would be like, you know, if you've ever gone camping, you have a little wee fire and you put a bunch of logs on, and then the fire goes out, right? I mean, that's kind of what happens when we overfuel. And that's what we can see now in some of the research with using continuous glucose monitors, is the fact that, you know, people are exercising and their blood sugars are going up and up and up and up and up. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, you're moving. You should be, it should be staying level or going down a little bit. And people, you know, that explains a lot of the bonking and the struggling with in competitions.
Constant glucose monitors. I had a point to make, or a question to ask you about that.
Awesome.
Something I know Ben Greenfield's talked about using these. He's a big self-quantifier. Paul Larson, and you make a point about this. There's a couple of pages of where you talk about Paul Larson, Dan Plews doing that little experiment. And I was actually in Kona when I had dinner with Paul and Dan. Dan was in Leeds, and I used to coach Dan when he was sort of 18 or 19. Caught up with him again in Kona, went round. They were one of my first podcast guests, and they cooked me dinner, and they were on the low carb, high fat train at that point, and they were wearing Dexcom G6s, and we had some wine, and about every 20 minutes after the wine there'd be a little ping, and they were like, what are all these texts? The CGM monitor telling us. So then I'd not heard of these before. They explained this whole story about what they were doing. And so then I did another podcast with Paul a couple of years later, and we were in Boulder then at a conference, and he was still wearing it, and he was showing me the little tracker and all of the spikes in his blood sugar or not. So I'm interested in using this, and is that something that you would, again, like with the microbiome testing, you know, it's, if you've got data, you need to sort of then use it to signpost an action. You can't just have the data. You've got to do something with it. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Do you need to wear them permanently, or is it just something that you would use for a month or two to get a feel for what happens with certain situations you're in, certain sleeping patterns, training sessions, foodstuffs? And once you've done that, then you're pretty much set in knowing how your body responds. Lots of questions there.
Yeah. I mean, CGMs are really interesting because it gives you a real time view of how the food you're eating impacts you. And, you know, we have, again, this sort of general concepts of glycemic index of foods, but that's more of a heuristic than an actual rule, because we see that, you know, you can have a low glycemic food. You can give the food bowls to an individual with a CGM, and all of a sudden, you know, they eat a banana and it looks like they've eaten a cookie. There was a classic study done, you know, 2015 where we saw this, right? Someone ate a cookie and had a beautiful blood sugar response. Another person ate a cookie and had a high glycemic response. And so, you know, with the CGM wearables, it's interesting because you can start to see just the peaks and troughs of your day. So how you don't have to change anything else. You just wear it, eat as you would do, and just observe how things are moving. You know, and ideally before you do that, before you do any kind of device, would be to kind of sit down and say, you know, what's my goal? Like, what am I trying to achieve? Because then when you apply a technology, you can always come back to that, because it's easy to get lost in all the data and noise. You can always circle back to, okay, what's my North Star? What am I really trying to achieve? Because, you know, one of the quotes that I love, you know, Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, you know, the first principle is you must not fool yourself. And of course, you're the easiest person to fool, right? And so This is where, again, if you have a coach or someone you're working with, it really helps if you're using a CGM, because they can let you know, okay, don't worry about that so much. These are the points. You know, we noticed that when you have oats with maple syrup in the morning, you know, you get a blood sugar response like you've eaten a bag of Haribos. Whereas if you have oats with some cinnamon and something else, you get a nice, you know, you stay nice and on point. And so those are the little insights. And, you know, you get some clients, again, and this is, again, whether it's genetics, your microbiome, or, you know, red wine, beautiful blood sugar response, no effect at all. You get other people, red wine, and it's like, you know, again, up the roller coaster, you know, blood sugars kick it off. So it's an interesting way to just be able to get an insight into what some things might be, you know, impacting your health or your fueling.
Yeah, interestingly, somebody had posted something recently, because there's this new Super Sapiens app out, and then they've got Levels Health as well, who've got an app, and so they're both sort of linked into working with either of the Dexcom or the Abbott Libre Sense thing that's coming out. So there's a movement growing towards this now, making it available to more than just people who've got type 1, type 2 diabetes or professional athletes. I know we're sort of running short on time here, Mark, and I've still got loads of stuff to ask you.
No worries.
I'll ask you quickly, in terms of nutrition philosophies. So I don't like to use the word diets, but, you know, there's so much now about keto is very popular. Although I suspect that most people don't, if they followed a real true keto diet, they get sick of it very quickly because it's restrictive. Low carb, high fat, we've already mentioned. We talked about paleo. We talked about carnivore. We you know, obviously it's vegan and vegetarian. Do you know Dr. Tommy Wood from... Tommy came on my podcast as well, and he has this great phrase of saying, look, if you've got a nutrition philosophy that's working for you, I can't argue with that. You might be one of the small number of endurance athletes that benefits from keto, but if it's working for you, how would I argue? However, do you tend to just favor eating real food and avoiding processed food and sugar rather than pointing somebody to a particular philosophy, unless there's a medical reason for doing so?
Yeah, I mean, great questions. I mean, this is where, you know, for me, all the different diets are like different tools in a toolbox. So you got a hammer, a screwdriver, all these types of things. And so if you're someone who, and it's fine to have a approach that you enjoy, I mean, that's great. But, you know, we do want to operate on principles. So again, how many grams of protein per kilogram body weight do we need? Doesn't matter if you're keto, paleo, vegan, we still need to achieve this amount. Similarly for, let's say, carbohydrate intake, depending on the individual's goals, like what are the totals that we're trying to achieve? And so, you know, if you're keto and you're doing well, to Tommy's point, hey, keep going. But when we're trying to, let's say you're getting a lot fitter and you have certain exercise bouts that, because you're performance driven, we know in the research, carbohydrate is going to benefit you. This is where you don't want to get so married to your hammer that you don't want to use a little bit of screwdriver or some other tool, right? You got to think of everything like a tool rather than, you know, I'm a this person and that's the only way I do it. Because, you know, again, this idea of roadblocks, you get into a challenge, you want to be able to have as many tools as you can to get over that roadblock versus just saying, all I've got is this one thing and God damn it, I'm going to figure it out using this. And that's where people can get stuck, right?
Yeah. Okay, look, we've still got loads to go. So let's see if we can whistle through these questions a bit quicker, Mark. Unless you can give me some overtime.
I got about 5 minutes, so we'll circle back and do a round two podcast.
Okay. All right. Quickly then, thoughts on self-quantification. We talked about CGMs. sleep monitors, HRV, that sort of stuff, in a sentence, yes, no?
Same idea. Like, you need to, why are you using it is always the first question. So write down your goals, write down why you're using it. And then it's nice to have somebody help you with the data, because these things are all helpful to like highlight things that you then circle back to your plan, nutrition plan, training plan, et cetera. But if you get so obsessed with how many hours of sleep you had, or if that sleep tracker is telling you how much REM sleep when it's not even that accurate, maybe to begin with, and it starts causing you more stress and anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
We got to find out which kind of side of the knife's edge we're on there.
Okay. And of course, again, Paul Larson talks about this new AI program that he's doing. We talked about HRV, and he actually surprised me when he said, HRV is good, but actually it's not one of the main priorities for us. We actually prefer to gather data on rate of perceived exertion, on how you felt a session went, and on the comments that you put. So a lot of the subjective stuff, which is interesting irony, really, for something that's AI is predicting actions based on data.
I find it fascinating that we have all this technology, and then as we parse through all this research, and again, HRV can be a valuable tool, particularly for endurance athletes, because it's cardiovascular driven, and so it can give you good information. I would say try to get yourself a coach or someone to help you tease out that information. But it is still, a beautiful thing, and shows you the complexity of the human body, that still the subjective perception of the person is going to be this great driver of actually how things are going. And so, finding a balance of subjective metrics and objective metrics that help to drive you towards your goals, and always with the idea of starting with as few as you can and then building it out. And, it's fine if you want to just use a tool and then just observe and whatnot, but make sure you are sort of just observing rather than, changing everything based on how you did yesterday or what it says this morning. And now all of a sudden you start making acute decisions and changing your training or nutrition plan. That's probably not going to lead you down the right path.
Okay, next question. If an athlete has constrained by his work-life schedule and he's got a hard bike session on one day and a hard run session on another, are there any, other than the stuff we've talked about, are there any recovery strategies that would really help him get ready for the next day?
Yeah, I mean, this always comes back to, again, context. Like, what are we trying to achieve in the training session? Because there's certain strategies where you would have a hard training session, you wouldn't fuel with carbohydrate. The following day, you'd have another training session, and that's purposely done. We're restricting carbohydrate on purpose to elicit an adaptation. Is that what we're trying to achieve, or are we building up in a hard training block and we're trying to push these sessions and we do need carbohydrate or various things to be able to get through them? And so, it is always tricky, but it's always context driven of what, who's that individual, how fit are they, and then what's the goal. And if we can come back to what the goal of the session is, if it is strictly recovery, then that's when we need to get enough protein, enough carbohydrate, and enough calories in to help to support recovery. And then you can look into, we talk about exercise-induced muscle damage. And so that's when you're looking at your, things like vitamin D and whey protein and creatine and some of the polyphenol drinks that can help with that as well.
Talking about creatine, again, Tommy Wood says that not just for bodybuilders, but he recommends that's just a good supplement with very little evidence of any side effects. Would you, yes or no, for creatine supplementation?
I mean, the big thing for endurance athletes is on the recovery side. So this idea of exercise-induced muscle damage is massive. And so we tend to think of, okay, it's for, rugby players, American football players, high school kids are trying to get, add 20 pounds of muscle. But that's not, it has a huge impact on obviously energy. It's providing ATP. But from the recovery standpoint, and as if you're training for an Ironman, recovery is a huge part of it. So definitely one to think about. And then that's where, on a race day strategy, there's a 4-week washout period. So you might gain some weight. So you might hold on to a bit more water with creatine, and that water is in the cell. So it's not a bad thing. But 4 weeks before your competition, you'd want to come off the creatine, because we know power to weight ratio is going to be important. And all of a sudden you can lose that 2, 3, 4 pounds and then perform your best.
So that's one thing people need to be aware of, is that when you start supplementing with creatine, you may notice some weight gain as well because of the extra, but that's mostly down to just hydration and retention of water. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be muscle mass over time, but yeah, water is a big one.
Self-compassion. You talk about self-compassion, but let's say you're doing a tough HIIT session and your body's screaming at you to stop. carry on with the "this really hurts" or "I need to be kind to my body." I mean, again, I guess it's to answer your question, it's down to context, what you're trying to achieve in the session.
Well, I think, I mean, for me during the session, I think that's more going to come down to like grit and these types of things. Like, can you endure? I think the self-compassion part probably comes with like, you did a session and then you said, "Oh, well, I didn't feel like I did my best." And you start beating yourself up. Or you missed a training session and you say, "Oh, geez, you're never going to make your goal if you keep missing this training session." And I think that self-compassion piece comes with like, hey, training for an Ironman's hard. It's not just hard for you, it's hard for everybody. And if you miss a training session, it's not the end of the world. You know, like that idea of we can't just keep cracking the whip on ourselves to try to motivate, because at some point it's really starts to do the opposite, and it's a lot earlier point than we think about. And depending how, you know, what your vintage is, how old you are, a lot of us kind of grew up. I know for me playing basketball, you know, it was always the harsh criticism was how we motivated. And then that's changed a lot in the last 20 years with the research. And so, you know, self-compassion is a big one for just saying, hey, you know, did we show up today? Great. Maybe it wasn't the best session. You didn't feel it was the best session, but that's all right.
Grit in the session, self-compassion afterwards.
There you go.
All right. It's the time that you said you need to go. I've got lots more questions. Do you need to go now, or do you want to leave and get another one, a part two?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I have a hard stop, but we're definitely happy to circle back and do a part two and, maybe crack into a few of the new book coming out in May, Peak 40. We can talk about some of those areas as well for folks.
Well, that would be good. When are you going to do a peak 57? Because I was 57 yesterday, so I'm looking at that other stuff.
Well, actually, I'll have to talk to you because the follow up. I don't want to get too ahead of the peak 60s. Looking like it's going to be coming out as well, so we'll have to pick your brain.
Well, that's interesting because I know how long it takes to write a book, so I might be approaching that one as the book comes out.
There you go. Right.
All right. Well, Mark Bubbs, fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show. We really must get together to do that other one. I will get back to you about all of the links that we're going to put in the show notes. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show, man. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, awesome. No problem. And people have questions, you can always reach out on social media at Dr. Bubbs, Twitter, Instagram. And I got a funny last name, so drbubbs.com. You can check out the website. And we have some nutrition programs for endurance athletes as well if people are looking for extra support.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
Thank you to Mark for joining me on this week's High Performance Human podcast. You can find links to everything that we discussed on the show in the show notes below. Now, a reminder that if you are interested in being part of my SWAT Inner Circle, you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please email beth@thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes below. So that's all for this week, and we'll be back in 7 days' time with another great guest. But for now, stay healthy and stay focused on being a high-performance human in every aspect of your life.